Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to begin our program today by taking a look at a new book that's out. It's called Green Sense for the Home, Rating the Real Payoff from Green Home Projects, from 50 Green Home Projects. And I've had a chance to look through the book. I'm really enjoying reading it. Eric Corey Fried is our guest today with us by phone. He's one of the authors. He has 20 years of experience in green building. He's the principal architect of Organic Architect. It's an architecture and consulting firm in San Francisco. He's the co-author of Green Sense for the Home, Rating the Real Payoff for 50 Green Home Projects. It's published by Taunton Press. And the co-author, Kevin Dahm, is an expert on financing custom homes and marketing. And he wrote Building Your Own Home for Dummies. And so he's not with us today, but Eric Fried is, and I'm really glad to have him here by phone to answer your questions and maybe take some of your comments about what you've done to make your home green as well. That we can take those questions as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Eric Fried, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
I tell you what, I really like how you've got this book organized, and rather than me describing it, why don't you talk about the three sections that you have in your book?
Well, we really wanted a book that overcame objections. So what we did is we came up with 50 green home projects, and they range everywhere from big things like installing solar panels down to simple things that even renters could do. So the three sections of the book that you mentioned are things that you could do today, you know, kind of simple afternoon projects, things you could do tomorrow that would be bigger weekend projects, and then things that you would do when you're kind of undergoing a remodel. And in each of these, we look at the opportunities of each and then look at the financial implications of each one.
And I really like how you have made it pretty pretty plain for any, you know, I can understand it. And I think almost anybody can understand it. And I like the practical approach that you've taken to the book. And I assume you had people like me in mind when you wrote it.
Well, it's funny because Kevin and I, my co-author Kevin and I, both wrote Dummies books, which is how we met. And I think we bring that that sensibility to it. But remember, we want this information to be accessible. We want every building to be a green building. And it's not a matter of just desire. I mean, in reality, that's the way it needs to be.
Well, let's take a for instance, so to give people an idea of what you're talking about here and sort of how you might cover it in the book. Let's take insulating your water heater. That's a simple one. Is that cost effective? Does that bring savings?
Oh, absolutely. Heating your water uses about 20% of the energy in your home. So what you want to do is you want to buy a simple water heater wrap. It takes about 15 minutes to install it. And then what you'll see is an immediate 5% savings in your water bill. And that thing will pay for itself in less than a year. And while you're there messing around with the water heater, you can turn the thermostat down. Most of us have it up a little too high. It only really needs to be at about 125 degrees in order to kill off bacteria and be hot enough to shower. And that way you're not heating up the water too much and then cooling it back down at the shower. You're just heating the water for as much as you need.
And that's an example of the first section of the book, 16 Green Things You Can Do Today.
Absolutely. And, you know, the first 10 things in the book, if you were to do those 10 things, you could save anywhere up to 50% of your home's energy bill just by doing those basic 10 things.
That's an amazing, I mean, you know, for here in Wisconsin where, you know, you take the heat and lights in the wintertime could run, for some people, probably $400 or $500. For us, it's somewhere around $250 perhaps at our home. On a cold in January, we've done a lot in our home to reduce our energy needs, but we might be able to do even more as I look through the book.
Well, as I say in the book, we really can't afford not to do these things, and it's kind of foolish if you don't do them. And that's why I really wanted to include things that even renters could do, things that have a payback of a year or less that anybody could feel are worthwhile.
Well, we'll take some calls, and if you own a home, you rent, you may have a question for us about some energy-saving thing that you might be able to do, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Kurt in Eagle River. Kurt, hello. Thank you for calling.
I think you're talking to Carl in Eagle River.
Carl, I'm sorry.
Okay. No problem. I have 28-year-old windows in my house here in northern Wisconsin, which has a low solar content to the weather. And been looking at the different glass that is available. I was going to just replace the sash as opposed to replacing the whole window. And what I'm concerned about is, first of all, what your recommendation would be for the south side of a house with a good solar view. And also, with these lower E windows, I was looking at three. The one is, they're made by Cardinal Glass. And the one is low E 366, which has a visual transmission of 65% and a solar heat, I guess you'd call it transmission of 27%. Mm-hmm. Which I think is awfully low. And then the two others, the one has a visual transmission of 70% low, or it's a U29, and the solar heat value is 37%. And then the one that I was thinking about is a U32, which is 79% visual transmission and a 65%, or, 0.65 solar transmission value.
All right, Eric, how do you assess the something like this?
Well, the thing is with windows, if you live in a really hot place, such as Arizona, it makes sense to tint the windows year-round. But in a place that gets very cold winters and kind of normal summers, I probably wouldn't look at tinting the windows. I'd look at a low-E glass to keep the insulation in. I definitely go with a double pane glass that's more bang for your buck to hold the heat in that you do have. And I would probably look at overhangs instead for the south side. You can size an overhang such that it shades the summer sun because the summer sun is higher in the sky. And then the winter sun can come in and warm the house in the winter, which is also kind of needed and important. And that'd probably be the better way to go in a place that has an extreme summer-winter cycle. I would also look at if you're only replacing the sash, I would definitely caulk and seal around the frame of the window. It only takes a few seconds for each window, and it's well worth the money.
Yeah. All right. There you have it. Thank you for calling, Carl. Appreciate your call. And Peggy in Tigerton, we'll turn to you. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Thanks for the good program. I can't wait to hear the rest of it. My question involves the steel roofing. We put steel roof on last fall, and one of our bidders gave us a choice between the standing seam and the type of roofing that probably a little more industrial. It shows the bolt, the nuts and bolts, mm-hmm. not the nuts, but the screws or whatever it is, the bolts. And we opted for the second because it was so much less expensive. And then we talked to some friends of ours, several friends, who said they never were even given the option. It was just steel roofing. Standing seam because it's probably more residential. And when I talked to someone who was looking to buy a house, they said, oh my gosh, I would never buy a house with that on. So I thought, uh-oh, now what have we done? We have the wonderful strong roof that isn't going to, it's going to last a long, long time with it in a great color, but did we make a mistake?
Was it environmentally? Yeah, okay, go ahead, Eric.
Well, from an environmental standpoint, metal, on the one hand, is a good thing because it's very durable, it's very weather-resistant. On the other hand, it takes a lot of energy to produce it. But at least it is recyclable, so if you ever decide to replace the roof, you could always recycle it into something else or sell it or give it away. The nice thing about the standing seam roof is for not just appearance, but snow loads. Mm-hmm. Because when the snow builds up, that smooth surface of the standing seam lets the snow kind of slip off.
Ooh, this one does too, though. Avalanche.
Oh, it does, even with the nuts? And then, the standing seam also is, just by its very nature, has fewer points of failure for leakage. because all the joints are covered.
Uh-huh.
Whereas when you have the exposed screws, especially each of those screw points becomes a potential source of leaking. But I've also seen metal roofs that where they installed one type of metal on the roof and then a different type of metal in the screws.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes we get this thing called galvanic action. If you ever seen a copper roof be installed, you have to install with copper nails. Otherwise, the nails will corrode from the copper, and then your roof will literally fly off.
Uh-huh.
But from an environmental standpoint, it's good that it's durable. And then what you want to do with any metal roof is make sure it's well insulated underneath, either in the attic or in the roof space itself, because the metal doesn't really provide much insulation at all.
We have a lot of ice dam problems, and that's why we went to the metal, because the snow doesn't stay. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking forward to not having water coming in.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And if you're having ice damming problems, you may be having some insulation issues in circulation issues in your attic, too, I would think, Eric.
Yeah, ice damming is usually a byproduct of heated air in one spot, which melts the snow, and then it hits the spot of the roof that has only cold air under it, so it freezes again and causes the ice dam. That can usually be solved with adding soffit vents around the soffit edge, but it depends on what your attic situation is.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Peggy. Appreciate the call. And we'll take some more calls as well. Let's turn to Kevin in Gays Mills next. Kevin, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was just listening with the caller about the window question, and we had like the old single pane windows in the house, and when you walked up in the wintertime, in seconds you could feel the heat on your clothes, and it heated the house during the day quite nicely. We put in new windows and went with low E windows, and you can walk up there and stand 10, 15 minutes. You don't feel any heat on your clothes. While they might keep heat in the house, they don't allow the sun to come in through the windows and actually heat the house. They don't transmit the sun through the house. Through the windows. Are there windows out there that would actually do that, like the old single panes that let heat in?
Okay.
Yeah, there are special windows that do a variety of things. In fact, I'm kind of working with a window company now that has windows that change their tint based on the time of year. So in the summertime, they're tinted, and they keep you cool, and in the wintertime, they go nearly transparent, and they let all the light in. What we do in that situation is we treat the windows on the south side of the house differently than the other three sides. So ideally, you'd want double or even triple pane windows around the house, so that way your heated or cooled air inside stays in the house. And if you want to get passive heating from the sun, we create passive windows on the south side that would be typically single pane. Typically, they'd be maybe even angled a little bit to avoid reflection. And they'd have overhangs, so they shade the summer sun and let the winter sun right in. And that's really the best way to go, because you're missing an opportunity there to keep your home nice and toasty in the winter.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling. Appreciate the call, Kevin. Eric Corey Fried, our guest today, is one of the authors of the book Green Sense for the Home, Rating the Real Payoff from 50 Green Home Projects. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Visiting with Eric Corey Fried today about his book, Green Sense for the Home. And he's got 50 projects, green home projects, that you can do. Some of them today, some of them that might take a little more than a day, and then some for if you're planning to remodel or if you're building a new home, things that you can put into that new home or into that remodel that will really help in terms of saving you energy dollars and also helping to save the environment. And, Corey, you've got a lot of experience in this. 20 years, you're the principal architect for Organic Architect. Talk about that, the work that you do.
It's funny because 20 years ago I was talking about these things, and it was really just a small group of hippie-like architects that were my mentors, and then a bunch of these old building performance guys that knew the ins and outs of heating systems and insulation. And they're really smart with buildings, but it was really a niche kind of subculture. And it's weird now that it's so mainstream. But yeah, for 20 years now, I've been designing green buildings, and it's it's great to see it's finally catching on.
And you can save, if over sort of, let's say, a quote-quote conventional home, you can save, in your book, as you're saying, you can save about 50% of your energy costs if you follow these some of these directions?
Well, it varies based on how old your home is and what kind of bad shape it is. You know, it also depends on where it is. There are certain states that have, like California, that have minimum energy codes now. So a new building is already doing a lot of these things that we're talking about in the book, at least somewhat. But, you know, you encounter these older, drafty, leaky homes, and they have these older systems. And if you do these things, just even these first 10 things, you could really cut your energy bill by up to half.
Let's turn to Glenna in Lyons next. Glenna, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I don't really have a question, but I just wanted to give a little suggestion. You know, we listen to the show all the time, and you all suggest people have energy audits. And after this winter, when we had really, really, really bad ice, icicles hanging all over the house, we decided to have the energy audit, and we were shocked at how much heat loss there actually was in the house, even though it's not that old. We bought it when it was 4 years old, and we've lived there for 11 years. So we thought it was a really well-built house, which it is, but, you know, it's in some respects. But the heat loss in the cans and not enough vents, and the insulation we found out was only R30. And then another thing is when the cable people installed the cable originally, because there were big coils of cable up there, they had pulled the insulation away from where it should have been in a lot of places. And so we did have this energy audit, and, you know, the things they suggested is the can lights, you know, to change or, you know, to, you know, make modifications to them too, so that they wouldn't leak so much air. And, you know, the roof vents and added insulation in a lot of places around the pipes where, you know, there was not insulation. So I just wanted to say, even though we thought our house was really well built and, you know, it was well insulated, it wasn't. And I think, you know, maybe people would be shocked to find out how much heat loss there is in their houses.
That's a good point. Comment, Eric?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's funny because we use, depending on where our projects are, we use these services that they come out with a thermal imaging camera, and they walk around your house, and you see through the TV screen where the heat loss is coming from, and most people are just shocked. If you add up all of the cracks around the windows and doors in your home, they equal the square footage of about an entire window. So imagine all winter long just leaving a window open, and that'll give you a sense of how many cracks are in the walls. And then you had mentioned the cable company moving the insulation, and then they forget to put it back. They're notorious for that. And you know, I encourage everybody to kind of check out the insulation, especially in the attic, to see if it's been pinched or stepped on or moved or anything, because it's literally the quote of going outside in the winter with leaving your jacket unzipped. And, you know, the thickest jacket in the world isn't going to do any good if you forget to button it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Glenn. I appreciate your call. We had another follow-up to the an email from the earlier call about windows, wondering, do tinted windows allow for plants to grow as well as they would with untinted windows?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, it depends on the plant, firstly, but mostly no, because the tinted windows and the low-E windows block UV light, and that's part of the spectrum that the plants use to grow. But like I said, it depends on the plant. But we've had a lot of issues where we put plants, you know, we have clients that put plants by some, you know, really tinted or coated window, and the plant just won't thrive at all. But there's ways around that, and if you think about it, if you're designing the whole thing, you need to think about what's best for your needs, and the plants will be part of that. Plants, by the way, are a great thing to put in your home. Not only are they pretty, but they also help filter the air. They absorb a lot of the pollen and, of course, CO2, and they produce oxygen.
So there are ways to get around that, you say?
It depends on the window that you want to use. You know, tinted windows are – I really only recommend tinted windows – in Southern California, Arizona, Texas, you know, places where you'd want the tinting year-round. Otherwise, half the year, it's going to work against you.
Yeah. Nancy emailed to ask about tankless water heaters. They're expensive to buy and operate. Do you think they're a good buy?
I get that question a lot. Tankless water heaters are great for certain things and for the right installations. What a lot of people do is they hear that tankless water heaters are green and energy efficient, so they replace a tank heater with a tankless model, and they find that they still have a lot of the same problems they had before. They're still waiting for water. All they're really doing is saving energy. Tankless water heaters are great for the appropriate installation, when you can locate it as close to the kind of big water source as possible. So if you can put it on one of the walls of the bathroom or close to the bathroom, then it really starts to make sense. But they have a lot of limitations. They need a gas fence. They need, in certain places, a 3-inch gas line, which you may not have in your house. You know, we've tried to install them other places, and we find that we simply can't because it would be too costly to dig up the old gas line and replace it. So you really have to look at what's appropriate. We have a whole chapter in the book just on improving your water heater. And I even talk about a new hybrid water heater that's kind of the best of both worlds. It's a small tank with an on-demand component plugged into it, so you kind of get the benefits of both.
Yeah. Along those lines, Andrew emailed in to ask, what's the payback for an instant water heater? Comparing the system with a solar hot water system is what he was after.
Well, I would really rather see the solar hot water system more than a tankless water heater. With a solar system, you put essentially these panels. They're not photovoltaic panels. They're kind of evacuated tube panels on the roof, and then that hot water just siphons naturally through physics, and then still needs to be stored in a normal tank heater. So you can keep your old tank heater in a certain sense, and then use that. And since water heat is 20% of your energy bill, you could essentially get that almost for free at certain points of the year.
Let's turn to Chris in Lake Geneva now. Chris, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, this is a great program. Obviously, everybody agrees. But I'm wondering if the book deals a lot with radiant heating. I have a friend who has it. He loves it. Everybody, all my friends are telling me to do it when I build my warehouse. However, it seems like on a small scale, it's fabulous. You save a lot of money. But on a large scale, for the large warehouse with high ceilings, not that the height of the ceilings makes a difference, but just what they want to charge me, I wonder if either I should only do it for the offices and not the warehouse where it doesn't have to be that warm and then solve that problem with windows, or if I should just do it with my friends myself before the concrete is poured. Do you have any input on that, Eric?
Well, radiant heat is great. It's very energy efficient, but it's also a very comfortable heat. It's great for people with allergies, too, because instead of blowing hot air on you, you're literally just heating the building, you know, the surface of the building itself. My inclination, without seeing the warehouse and the size of it, would probably be, my gut reaction would be to just heat the offices, and I'll tell you why. The offices are used probably, I'm assuming, 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 or something like that.
Right.
You can kind of put the radiant heat on that zone, and you can even set a timer to go on an hour before the employees come in so they arrive to a nice toasty office, and then, you know, shut it off even a couple or 3 hours before they leave, and then just use the mass of the concrete to kind of stay toasty through the afternoon and save a lot of energy. In the warehouse, because it's such a big space, the radiant heat probably wouldn't be as beneficial. Plus, you have to figure that in any warehouse, 30 to 40% of it is shelving space and probably rotating shelving. So you'd have heating tubes running under shelving, and you'd be heating things you don't really need to heat. So you'd be wasting energy. I'd probably rather see kind of centralized, smaller, efficient units, ceiling fans that would, in the winter, blow the hot air down on you, and in the summer, suck the hot air out. Because remember, ceiling fans go in two directions, and do it that way. But in the offices, the radiant heat will be so super cozy. In fact, you could, you know, I don't know if you do this at your office, but you could take off your shoes and then walk around barefoot.
Right. Yeah, providing the smell isn't too bad, right?
Exactly.
Do you have a section in your book that deals with more commercial construction?
No, this book is Green Sense for the Home, but a lot of these things apply to commercial stuff, absolutely. And a lot of the same rules apply. Certainly all the overview of the systems all work, but the book really focuses specifically on houses. And then, you know, we've been talking about doing a Green Sense for commercial construction, but because so much is similar, I don't know if it'd be worth it.
Well, you've got a fan of both, even though you haven't published the other one. So thank you very much for your answers.
All right. Thanks,
okay.
Chris. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Tom in Green Bay next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I've got this idea of doing a do-it-yourself, build it in the garage and put it up on the roof solar project for either heating or hot water. And I'm just wondering what resources you could direct me to get better information and if that's really practical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Solar hot water is one of those things that a lot of people do on their own. What's nice about it is that the electrical connections are pretty minimal and the plumbing connections are relatively simple. It's not for everybody, but there's a lot of do-it-yourselfers that kind of tackle it themselves. And there's a lot of kind of websites and things that talk about this. There's a bunch of manufacturers that will sell you just components, and you can kind of put it all together yourself. And I guess it really depends on how handy you are. The key is not the installing of the thing. The key is picking the right type of hot water heater, hot water collector on the roof, because there's kind of three basic types. And you want to pick the thing that's most appropriate. Each one has kind of pros and cons based on weight and efficiency and cost.
And would I find that in your book?
Absolutely. In the book, I talk about all three.
Okay.
The most efficient type are these evacuated tube collectors. They kind of look like a long thermos, and they're vacuum tubes, and the kind of water bubbles up between them and heats very efficiently. But they cost twice as much as kind of the standard flat plate collector. Which is not as efficient, so you probably need more of the flat plate type than these evacuated types, so it kind of balances out. You also, in Wisconsin, you're going to have issues of freeze and thaw, so what you do is either in the winter you drain the system, or in some cases we use glycol in the system, and then transfer the heat from the glycol, which doesn't freeze, to hot water down below. But all of that is kind of easily done, and there is this community of do-it-yourselfers that kind of get into all this stuff. And I encourage you to do it.
Give it a shot.
Give it a shot. I mean, it's a lot of fun. If you go to energystar.gov, you can kind of get a bunch of information on financial resources, and you can also find some tax credits there to kind of help you out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Eric Corey Fried, our guest today, one of the authors of Green Sense for the Home, rating the real payoff from 50 green home projects. Great to have him along today. I know there are lots of callers who want to visit with you, so we'll turn right back to the phones and on to Matt in Green Bay. Matt, hello to you.
Hey, guys. Hopefully your day is going well. Great program, as always.
Thank you.
Couple of quick questions for you. One is they've got differences in insulation types. You know, you see the pink foam board that they like to put down under foundations before they pour a basement slab.
Yeah.
And there's also the type that's a real thin mat that's got a real shiny coating on it. Can you talk about the differences between the two, the pros and cons of using either or? And I got a follow-up question because we've preset our basement for radiant heat, but we haven't turned on the radiant heat yet or plumbed it up yet.
There are lots of different types of insulation. The most common type is the one that everybody kind of thinks of, which is the pink fiberglass stuff. It's also called bat insulation. That is, it's fine, except there are some issues with it. One is, it's fiberglass, so you need to wear gloves and a mask when you install it or deal with it, which is a little weird. And they treat it with formaldehyde, which is a known cancer-causing chemical. So it's kind of strange to put that in your house where you sleep.
Right.
The rigid board that you talked about for the foundations is really the reason I use it for the foundation is that it doesn't compress. It's rigid. So when you pour the concrete against it, it makes a lot of sense. But you don't get as much R value per inch with it. It's also much more expensive, too, which is why we only limit its use in certain spots. The insulation I like is this stuff called bio-based, which is the soy-based foam. And it's a spray foam, and you spray it into the cells of the walls, and it foams up and fills the entire wall cavity. And it's a closed cell, and it has a very high R value, and you really get a much higher insulation value. Plus, it fills every nook and cranny in the wall, so it's
yeah. We've sprayed our complete house has been sprayed down, top, ceilings, lids, the whole bit. I'm concerned more of the basement slab, the floor of the basement, and the difference between that big thick pink foam board or the real thin, shiny mat surface on it.
Yeah, the foam mat essentially has these, it almost looks like those little popper things that you get in a package. And they have little air bubbles in, and then it's a reflective surface. The rigid board is going to have a much higher insulation value. And if you're going to be insulating the basement, not only do you want to insulate the floors and the ceiling, but also the walls and all the slab edges. A lot of heat, especially with radiant heat, will trickle out of those slab edges. So it's a very easy thing while you're doing it to insulate. It's impossible to do after the fact. So make sure, well, you know, make sure after they pour, they get those edges, and you really see a payback on it almost immediately.
All right. There you-
if we would hook up our basement for the radiant that we've already run the tubes in for, I'm assuming that's a tremendous energy savings running with radiant heat in the basement slab and then having that trickle up to the rest of the house.
Well, not only that, but what I think you'll find is that you might leave the basement on kind of a low, you know, a nice low heat all winter long, and then the heat rises, and then you'll start to feel it on the first floor, and I don't know if you have a second floor, but you might feel it on the second floor, too. Some people notice that they can just kind of leave the basement on, you know, throughout the winter and never have to turn on the upper levels.
Wow.
In fact, sometimes on a second level, we won't even put tube heat. We'll put electric mesh radiant just for the, you know, the occasional thing, because it's only on for a few hours at a time, and we'll just let the rating of the basement kind of act as an engine to keep the entire building warm.
All right. There you have it. Thank you, Matt, for calling. And Julie in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Julie.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Years ago, I saw, actually, and from the Germany, it's a kind of product you just attach to the faucet. I believe it is electrical. And right away, it gives the hot water. And I tried to find in the United States, and I couldn't. Is there any products like this in the United States, I wonder?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's two types. There's electrical and gas. They're called on-demand water heaters, and they're often confused with the whole house on-demand systems that have become popular in the last few years. But you can find them. They're really great for bathrooms that are, you know, off, disconnected from the rest of the house, or guest house bathrooms or pool house bathrooms, or, you know, any bathroom where you don't want to run a hot water line all the way to it. You just put on these little on-demand things, and they're tiny little boxes. They sit under the sink, and they just generate enough hot water for whatever you need. If there's a shower in the room, you'd get a bigger box just to handle that. But if there's just a faucet, you're not going to be using that much hot water for like a powder room or something. They're pretty small, they're pretty inexpensive, and they're pretty easy to install. You should be able to find them at Lowe's, Home Depot, you know, like that. And if you Google online, you can just look for on-demand water heater.
On-demand water heater.
On-demand water heater. Is there any store that we can buy all these good products about the environmental products we can find for home repairs?
All right. Where do you go to look for green products?
Well, it varies based on where you are in the country. In Wisconsin, I'd have to look up the best place to go. But what I can tell everybody to do is check out a site called greenhomeguide.com. And from there, you can find the local sources for all sorts of things. And it's kind of a good place to start. And that's probably the best start. Otherwise, what I can do is find specific places in Wisconsin and send them to you, and the radio can put it on the website.
Yeah, I can put it up on my Facebook page. Yeah, if you do that, Eric, I'd appreciate it. We'll put it up on the Facebook page.
There's also the Wisconsin Green Building Alliance, WGBA.org, which can also help you find out a bunch of information about where to go and where to buy it from.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Angie in Waukesha, we'll turn to you. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I live in a trailer home, and it's built in the late 80s. And I'm trying to find inexpensive ways to kind of make it a little bit more efficient. My fuel bill is like $100, $120 a month, and that's a lot for me. So I'm trying to find, like, more inexpensive things I could do to a trailer.
Yeah.
Well, the trailers are difficult because their insulation value is pretty low. So all your heat is essentially just leaking outside. So the real thing I would target would be as much insulation as possible. There's kind of inexpensive ways to do it with foam and boards and things like that. There's even kind of cheaper things that you can do with caulking and sealing. A tube of caulk is, you know, $5, and you can kind of caulk and seal around the windows. that'd be another way to go. But the trouble is that those walls are so thin to begin with, it's hard to add insulation.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to add it to the inside because it'll eat into your interior space. You can't really add it to the outside because there's already siding there. So that means you have to re-side the thing, which would be expensive. Probably the best thing to do would be looking for ways to caulk and seal what you can. I would also, you know, one easy, simple thing that a lot of people miss is that electrical outlets and light switches that are on the exterior walls are notorious sources of leaks. And if you take those little switch plate covers off, you can feel the cold air in the wall. One thing you can do is, you know, you can get these little foam gaskets that are the same size as the switch plate cover. They cost about 15 cents each. You just put them on each of those exterior outlets and wall switches. And believe it or not, you'll see a remarkable difference.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Well, what kind of response have you gotten from your book so far, Eric?
Well, the book's been a big hit. I've been talking to people all over the country. Right now, I'm in Minneapolis speaking at the Greening the Heartland conference, which is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been speaking all over and talking to radio people all over. And you know, what's been interesting to me and kind of refreshing for me is that I find that no matter where you are in the country, everybody is interested in saving money. Everybody is interested in saving energy, and everybody, you know, wants to do these things. So it's very heartening. And what I don't encounter is I don't find people saying, "No, I'm not interested in saving energy or money." That's stupid. So it's a very positive. It's a very positive thing for me.
Well, I can believe that, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And don't forget to send me that information. I'll put it up on our Facebook page.
Okay, great. We'll do.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Eric Corey Fried is the co-author of the book Green Sense for the Home, Rating the Real Payoff from 50 Green Home Projects, and does it in such a way as very, very great illustrations, talks about what the project will do for you, what it'll do for the earth, how it'll save you money, what it's going to cost, what about maintenance. Really goes into all of the details, and written for those of us who who aren't in the business ourselves, but there are things that we can do. Every one of us could do those first 10, 15 things in the book, which are things you could do today. And as Eric said, if you follow those, the first 10, you can cut your bill by about 50%, which is quite a little chunk of change for many people. So I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at the book. Again, it's Green Sense for the Home. The author's Eric Corey Fried. The other author is Kevin Daum. And it's building your own, really doing some things to cut your energy bill and save the environment, help save the environment. So really pleased to have Eric with us, and hopefully we can talk with him again. I hope so. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at the National Landscape for Agriculture and Ag Policy. And I'll tell you what, you think agriculture, ag policy, what? If I'm not farming, what impact does that have on me? Well, it has quite a bit of impact. Molly John, who is now serving as Deputy Undersecretary of Research, Education, and Economics in the USDA, will be our guest. Coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.